This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Infinity Goes Up on Trial is the name of the latest podcast to join the FM Podcast Network. It's Dylan-related, as you may have guessed, but it has a different angle than any of the existing Dylan podcasts. It's hosted by Aaron Callahan, who's been a guest on this show, and you may know from the World of Bob Dylan Conference, her posts as In the Fishbowl on Twitter, or as the person who has done quite a few interviews on the Dylantants podcast. On her new show, Aaron is talking to people we don't usually hear talking about Dylan, artists, activists, educators, and more, with a focus on the universal nature of ideas and emotions in Bob Dylan's work. As you'll hear in the first episode, it results in an interesting new way to think about Dylan and his impact in the world. Infinity Goes Up on Trial will come out monthly, and I hope that you'll go and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Music or whatever platform you use to listen. Subscribers to FM Plus, our premium membership program, should have received a new personal feed to make sure that you get every show. As part of our network, there will be extended and bonus episodes exclusively for FM Plus subscribers. But for now, we want to introduce everyone to this new show so you can hear the full episode right here. If you want to see the video version of this full interview, it's beautifully filmed and probably a better way to enjoy it if you have the time, go to the FM.club website. It's right on the homepage. Check out the show notes for relevant links. Aaron's got a Substack and there's a bunch of other stuff there. But for now, let's listen to the premiere episode of Infinity Goes Up on Trial, Aaron Callahan's interview with Jason Nadler.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Infinity Goes Up on Trial. I'm your host, Aaron Callahan, and I am with this beautiful human, Jason Nadler, today. Jason founded the Catastrophic Theater with Hamry Cooper in 2007. His original plays include Blue Finger, The Fall and Rise of Herman Brood, Life is Happy and Sad, Speeding Motorcycle, Meat Bar, King Ubu is King, and In the Under Thunderloo. He's directed more than 50 productions in Houston, Austin, Atlanta, Providence, Pittsburgh, and New York. Jason was recently awarded Best Director for 448 Psychosis and has been awarded Best Artistic Director by the Houston Press, is an NEA McDowell Colony Fellow, a four-time MAP Fund grantee, and a recipient of an individual artist grant from Creative Capital. He was Artistic Director of Infernal Bridegroom Productions for 10 years. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I am so grateful that you're here. Jason and I have been friends for more than 25 years.
Sounds right.
We met in the last century when we were still both in our 20s. You're about to turn 30, though. So tell me how you got into Bob Dylan.
My parents didn't listen to music when I was a kid. I remember that my father had one 8-track. It was Jim Croce's greatest hits. And I had a stepfather who had Cat Stevens' greatest hits. And otherwise, there was no music playing in the car ever. My parents divorced when I was 5. My parents are both sort of civilians. They're not very interested in art or music or anything like that. Right after I got my driver's license, I was driving and listening to classic rock station, and I heard "It's All Right, Mop, I'm Only Bleeding," and I was blown away. I recognized everything in it. I felt everything in it. I screeched and made a U-turn back to Cactus Records or music. And I said, hey, I'm looking for this song, "It's All Right, Mom, I'm Only Bleeding." I can't remember it's by Bob Dylan or Bob Seger, you know?
That's awesome.
That gave him quite a laugh. And I said, do you have that? Do you have an album with that on it? And he said, well, I'll sell you Biograph. It has everything on it.
No.
And so, of course, it doesn't have that song on it, but it introduced me to Dylan's entire career up to that point. And, you know, when I heard that song and I heard him sing, because I don't have any elder siblings, and my parents divorced when I was so young, so I wasn't brought up really with a father. Dylan felt like to me that I had found my father.
Wow.
Things made sense to me. I had someone to look up to, and he's sort of been that for me ever since.
That's incredible. I think it's really cool how the first generation, we talk about this a lot in Dylan world, that they experienced Dylan in sequential order. So watching that progress, you know, from beginning and through is meaningful to them. But folks who didn't have that experience, their entry point is meaningful to them, and they always go back to that, whether it's a song or an album or something. And I wonder, do you go back to Biograph a lot, or is it really It's All Right Mom, Only Bleeding? And then what is it about that song that resonates in particular?
No, I don't often go back to the things that I've listened to so many times. It's like I can just dial them up in my head if I want to. I mean, if I'm at a show, I don't need to hear All on the Watchtower or like Rolling Stone or something like that.
No.
I listen to the newer stuff, the bootleg series, stuff that's come out more recently.
Mm-hmm.
I love Self-Portrait. I love Street Legal. I love Empire Burlesque.
Okay.
You know, these are not popular albums, but I love them very much. Under the Red Sky, not so much. So I don't really go back to it. There's an exception. I've gotten really into music reaction videos, and I love to see younger people reacting to Dylan songs, and those are generally classic songs.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really, one thing that's really shocking to me about it is way more often than not, their first reaction is, he's such a beautiful singer.
Okay.
He's so soothing as a singer. I can't get enough of his voice. I can't get enough of his harmonica playing. So that's new, you know? And I think that there's a real distinction between, there are two kinds of music reactors, I think, particularly with regard to Dylan. And one sort tries to analyze everything and wants to know what Dylan was thinking or what he meant or what he was trying to put across to us. And then there's one guy that I really love who says, I'm going to listen to this without interruption, and at the end, I'll try to figure out how it made me feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the way that Dylan songs work best. I think you're like walking right by the greatest gift of them if you're trying to understand them.
Right.
And so I really appreciate that, you know, it when someone who does one of these reaction videos is just open to it, letting it wash over them, letting it do whatever it's going to do to them.
And you've texted me a few times that hours went by and I was watching these videos.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is an authentic answer. So you struck on something that really is the heart of why I started this show.
Uh-huh.
And I'm incredibly grateful to you and indebted to you that you sent me a text on December 8th. And it was just a beautiful message. And it starts like, I don't know why I'm sending this to you. But will you share a little bit about that text? You know, what you wrote in it.
Well, first of all, I never know why I'm doing anything. You know, as a director, I walk into the room and always say, I have no idea how to do this play. And
right.
We just follow our noses and we make it together. I think I was talking about how does it feel?
Right.
In Like a Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And it often blows my mind how something has, you know, I've listened to Dylan constantly since I was 15, 16. And so many things have gotten under my skin in a way that I don't even recognize. I think that I've had an idea based on my own idiosyncratic belief system, and then I have a revelation, I hear something, and I go, oh, it's not based on my idiosyncratic belief system, it's based on Dylan's, or it's based on mine that I come to honestly through Dylan's. So things are always occurring to me, and for 30 years I've been talking about the importance of feeling in response to art versus thinking in response to art.
Right.
And if you really want to hurt my feelings, come see a play that I directed, come up to me afterwards and say, that really made me think. Because that's absolutely not what I'm trying to do. So I've been banging away at this idea for like 30 years now. Mm-hmm. And it took me until like the day before I sent you that text to realize that the hook on Dylan's most like famous song is number one, you know, the number one song in Rolling Stone, whatever.
Right.
That the hook was, how does it feel? How does it feel? And that had passed me by so long without me relating it to my own belief system about art.
It's interesting, and I put this in the notes when we were going back and forth, because in the 2019 World of Dylan, Ann Power did a presentation on, that was called, and I have it here, Bob Dylan's Body, because we so often see him, you know, associated with the head or the mind or something, and it does lead to logos instead of pathos. And you wrote in response to your art, which I thought was so beautiful, and I hope they will all feel something different according to their lived experiences. And, you know, I don't know that we really need to tell me more about that, but it's like, you know, we had that conversation. But if you want to share more about that, that would be great. Because Laura Tenchard and I were talking about this also, as I was making notes, that I had the word feeling to art to feeling to empathy, and then that you know, there's this deep connection to those, you know, individual experiences that lead us to maybe shared human experiences. And I wonder, you know, if you have an idea about that.
Yeah, I do. I think it's very common to Dylan's own idea. You quoted philosophy of the modern song to
I
me in a way that, do you remember the quote?
It is, money is an agreement, art is a disagreement.
Yes, that one, but the one about the important thing about a song is how
it makes you feel about your own life.
Yes.
Yes.
So that's the way that we work.
Right.
And we, you know, we do a lot of experimental work.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of double meanings, triple meanings. There's not a clear meaning that you walk away with.
Right.
And we try to preserve every possible meaning, mm-hmm. and we try to retain the ambiguity. And we do that in order that the audience, each member of the audience, is able to draw as many personal associations as possible,
mm-hmm.
So that they can experience the work in a way that makes them think about their own lives or feel something about their own lives. I love it when somebody wanders away in their minds at one of our plays, loses all focus on what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
and starts to feel something about themselves. And that's... that's, I think, how Dylan works. And
right.
His work is so ambiguous in most cases. And he's not trying to deliver a clear message. Now, audience members get frustrated by that sometimes.
Right.
But they don't get frustrated by instrumental music.
No.
You know, you feel something in response to that. You feel something in response to contemporary art or something like that. There is no meaning. It's how it makes you feel.
But I think this is interesting. Because there, you hit on a few things, and I have a few follow-ups. But that woman who heckled him the other night, play Something We Know.
Yeah.
And I always say there's always going to be that person that wants a jukebox or a legacy act. And there are so many people who bring expectations to what Dylan is to them, or they are bringing expectations maybe in what you do to what the theater experience is. And you're not, as you know, as lovely as the alley is, you're not doing that.
Right.
And so I think that that may be a disconnect in how people are coming to the art and the expectation they have in their experience. And I think that you said something about a special note that you had to write when you did your show Speeding Motorcycle in Austin. And I think that speaks to kind of what I'm saying with the expectation people bring to the art form.
Right. So Speeding Motorcycle was a rock opera that I constructed from the entire body of work of Daniel Johnston, the kind of king of bedroom pop for lonely people,
mm-hmm.
Also schizophrenic, also bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And he has an enormous catalog of songs. So we did this play in Austin, and it wasn't quite linear. It was about a series of feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Those feelings were clear to people from our audience. They were clear to most people.
Mm-hmm.
But this theater that we performed in Austin was their largest theater. They had a very older subscriber base. They were used to seeing very traditional work. And they were frustrated that they didn't understand what the message was or what the meaning was or what they were supposed to take away from it. So I was asked to write a program note for the second week. And somewhere over the course of that program note, I said, art is not the news. It's not the story of what happened, it's the story of how it felt.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of a philosophy that drives everything that we do.
Excellent, excellent. So you're saying that gets to my next question, or maybe answers it, is how does this idea inform your approach to directing or writing or to art in general? And I think you've answered that. But then what specific, are there Dylan lyrics or performances that make you feel in particular ways, and what stands out to you?
Yes, there are a lot, but, you know, like most Dylan fans, it changes by the day, it changes by the hour, it changes according to, do I need to pee? You know, I mean, it changes according to anything.
Yeah.
Sometimes a lyric will present itself
mm-hmm.
as sort of an earworm, and I try to track down where that came from.
Right.
So recently I heard, I couldn't stop hearing, I gained some recognition, but I lost my appetite. And I finally tied that to the 10th year of Infernal Bridegroom, when I got so profoundly burned out that I had to go on the road. And I realized that that lyric was very much about that. It was very much about, you know, I gained some recognition, but I'd lost my appetite for it. And Dylan certainly had that experience.
And so, like Dylan, where maybe you're Dylan in 66 and you retire, but you're still you're retired from the Houston scene, but you're still off, and you were in Pittsburgh then, right?
I moved all over.
Yeah, you did.
I just fell into gigs. I wasn't trying to.
Right.
I'd be in a town, and I'd have a friend, and they'd say, you should really meet this person. So I'd go have a drink with them, because mm-hmm. they're like, you would relate to them artistically. Right. They have a theater. And I'd go there, and we'd get drunk, and we'd talk, and the next thing I knew, they were like, hey, you need to direct a play for us. And then they would assign me a play. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was difficult, having come from a place where I was choosing all of the plays that I directed.
Yeah, of course.
And that ultimately led to me coming back.
That's interesting. So that led to you coming back. Did you have sort of a, you know, Bob Dylan in the jazz club moment where you're like, this is the moment that's going to, you know, reinvigorate my artistic, you know, the desire to create? Or were you just, you wanted to come home because you had more autonomy here?
I wanted to come home because I needed to make a reliable income, okay. because I was able to do the work that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But really, I'm never as conscious of why I'm doing something as, you know, I'll go home because it will reinvigorate me.
Right.
You know,
it's more of a feeling.
It's an instinct. It's an impulse that I often don't trust, but mm-hmm. I follow it anyway. Maybe this doesn't apply, but I think about this a lot. Do not create anything. It will be misinterpreted. It will follow you the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't trust these kind of instincts. I just go along with them. I don't know anything else to do. I don't know how to do anything else. So this is, I can years later say this is why,
right.
maybe. But at the time, I have no idea. And it's like the way that Dylan writes, I think. You know, the scraps of paper that he eventually puts together mm-hmm. and everything. I'm discovering what I'm doing as I do it.
Right.
I don't come in with a plan. I come in to direct a play and I say, I have no idea how to direct this play. And if I did have an idea about how to direct it, I think I would need to leave the theater. You know, it just wouldn't be of any interest to me whatsoever.
Right.
We used to work in an outside-in way, which means that you do something with your body and it makes you feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were doing that, the joke is, I used to say, could you please cry a single tear out of your right eye on this line?
Yes.
Or on this word.
Right.
You know, and if the play is 2 hours and 7 minutes, we want it to be 2 hours and 7 minutes always. You know, and that's really anathema to the idea of inside out, which is you feel something, and maybe that causes your body to do something. And so I don't do any staging now, which mm-hmm. is very, very unusual.
Right.
Or blocking, as it's sometimes said. We come in, we all remain very, very open. I might have thoughts coming into the play,
mm-hmm.
But I don't try to teach them. I don't try and explain what I'd like to say with it, or every actor would just be giving their best impression of me performing every role in the play. It needs to be personal, you know,
right.
It needs to come from the actors themselves.
Do you find that actors find that difficult? Because it kind of jumps questions, but this is maybe how Dylan performs as a band leader,
yes.
that he doesn't, I mean, he calls audibles. I just told you about the 3 nights I saw him in Chicago, and the second night he turned to Tony and said 2 syllables and they launched into Truckin', which maybe wasn't planned, but we loved it. But, you know, he expects musicians to follow, and you know, he'll say, I mean, Ray Padgett could probably tell you, you know, speak on this because he talks to Dylan's band members all the time, but he'll just say, like, play something like this, or like, you know, and he doesn't give too much. He expects them to feel their way through it, and he's stingy with direction. Is that how, do you feel a sense of kinship in how you direct, and does that make actors uncomfortable?
It does sometimes. I mean, I have two, I think, brief stories about that. Mm-hmm. Kyle Sturdivant, who you know, he was one of the 3 Joe the Boxers, and Speeding Motorcycle Carry was another.
Mm-hmm.
The first time that I worked with him, we were working with 3 actors that we worked with for a very long time, and he felt like he was missing something. And he said, just tell me what to do and I'll do it.
Right.
And I'll make you very happy. And I said, I'm not going to do that. You know, these actors don't understand anything that you don't. They're listening to each other and they're responding spontaneously. And that's what I needed to do. And he was very frustrated by that.
Mm-hmm.
But on opening night, he grabbed me at the bar and gave me a big hug and said, thank you for never telling me what to do. I feel like I'm an actor now.
Everything I've seen him in, he's just brilliant.
Yeah, and very dropped in and very authentic.
Yeah.
And I think that goes back to not being a sort of a robot who follows instructions.
Right.
A lot of directors come in and teach the play.
Right.
You know, and they already have an idea about it. The other brief question, and I think that this is about my ex, and we were working together. They're a brilliant actor, they're a brilliant writer,
mm-hmm.
And I think that they misused the word or the term Socratic question here, but But I asked them a question about how they felt in this moment, or what they thought about this moment, or whatever. And they got their back up and they said, "Is that a Socratic question?" And I said, "Well, I can't remember what a Socratic question is. I used to know, I can't remember."
Right.
And
sure.
She said, "A question to which you already know the answer." And she was like, "Are you like testing me?"
I think
you
that know? Is a misuse of Socratic question.
I'm sure, yes, yeah. Now I understand what it is, but right. I still like the anecdote, so I still
yeah,
use
of
it.
Course.
And I said, "Actually, okay, good question. It's not, I do have an answer. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that you have a better one,
right.
Or one that comes from you personally, mm-hmm. because all great art is personal."
Right.
See, yeah, I have one, but it's mine.
Right.
You know, it's like Dylan says, "I can tell you who Mr. Jones is in my life, mm-hmm. but we all have our own Mr.
Right.
Jones." You know.
Right. So, I've also noticed, and you mentioned Kyle Sturtevant, and you and Tamara have worked together for a long time, and I think Anthony Barilla, you guys work together a lot. So this to me speaks to Dylan's world, that there is a tight circle of trust. And does that come from the way that you work? I mean, like what, how is it that you have gained the trust because people know that they're going to be safe to create in that space? And I'm just interested to know, you know, and people are, not only are they loyal to Dylan, but there are some folks that just won't talk once they've been with Dylan. And that's it. I can imagine that Tony Garnier at some point may, Sarah
yeah.
Dylan never will.
Yeah. Well, but, Sarah Dylan's gone.
But. Yeah. But how did you develop that? And because that seems incredibly similar to Dylan's circle.
That closeness,
yeah.
would you say? Well, ensemble has always been very important to me. From the beginning, mm-hmm. there were like four core values, and that was one of them.
Right.
Every meaningful movement that's happened in theater has come from ensemble mm-hmm. or from a playwright that upended the status quo, like a Beckett,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's not just those three people that I've worked with for that long, and you know that I worked with Carrie for an extraordinarily
yes.
long time, too.
Yes.
We have a core of, I'd say, 20 artists that mm-hmm. have been working together for over 30 years.
Right.
And that builds trust, and that, and you know each other better, and, mm-hmm. and you go through things together, and we had Thanksgiving together. We don't do it anymore, but we did that every year for about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Dylan does that with his bandmates.
I don't think so.
I think he creates a sense of trust and,
right.
and closeness, maybe,
right.
Over the period of time that he plays with them.
Mm-hmm.
But some of his closest friends say, you know, he'll always be my super close friend.
Right.
I haven't seen him in 20 years.
So is know? There that, I mean, maybe it's because you and Tamari and Carrie and a bunch of that core group went to high school together. So there's a sense of equality there. Is it that when it comes, at the end of the day, Dylan's still the boss? Where you're the artistic director and Tamari's the production artistic director, but and you're the bosses, but there's a sense of equality maybe more than there is with Dylan, who is right. so singular.
We used to work in a way that everything pretty much came from my belief system and my mm-hmm. point of view and how I thought that art was bullshit and needed to change, you know, and
right.
that created an opening for me, especially mm-hmm. theater. I was like, there's an open lane here. I can't relate to any of this. This has nothing
right.
to do with me. And so we created this, it was sort of it was a theater for people who hated theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was a theater for punks and, you know, people who loved music much
right.
more than theater. That was how we started out. The people from HSPVA that we went to high school with, mm-hmm. there were maybe like three of them
right.
left, okay, because it's an ever-evolving ensemble. Most of the people that we that we've worked with over the long term have not been people that we knew before they came into the room.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been told many times that they found their first sense of community there, they found their first sense of purpose there.
Mm-hmm.
Even people have said, it saved my life. You know, and I really think that that just goes to the closeness
right.
that is developed there, the chosen family, you know?
Clearly, I mean...
And I'm not sure Dylan has that, you know?
Right.
I mean, Dylan is not just a very, very strange man, you know, who I don't think anybody will ever understand with the possible exception of his family.
Maybe, yeah.
But he's also, I think, very estranged from the world because you go through the experience of being Bob Dylan. How are you not?
Right.
You know? These are people who were estranged from the people that we work with,
mm-hmm.
felt estranged from the world, and found comfort and community and family in our group. So I think that's a distinction.
That goes to, I just told you one of the lines that always resonates with me that's a consistent is, I'm a stranger here and no one sees me.
Yeah, man.
And
yeah,
I feel like you're
too,
saying that
too.
About those folks.
Yeah, no, that one gets me every time.
Yeah, always. And just, and then it's like, except you. And there's that one person that you hope, you know. And I do think
you know what? That's my favorite love song by him, actually.
Me too. Because he doesn't say love until the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're both from the same album.
Yes.
I mentioned the gained some recognition. But
yeah.
It's, very underrated album.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We agree on that. We agree on a lot of things. All right, so I do want to talk about, let's talk, and that's my, hopefully we can edit. I always say in the audio podcast, I say, David will edit that out, but maybe okay. He won't, and it'll be charming. So we have mentioned a few times our friend Carrie, and I can say that I knew you before, I knew your work before I knew you, and I know that you cringe when I say that my friends who were actors were terrified of you because they had to audition. And you had that recognition of being a genius and being so brilliant and whatnot. And
so wrong.
But, you know, there
thank,
is something...
Thank you.
There, no, it's not so wrong because you are all of those things, but that wasn't my entry point to you. My entry point, much like people having different entry points to Dylan, was through Carrie. And Carrie was my first friend in Houston. That I moved to Houston. I had no friends. And the first day I met him, we were wearing the same shoes. And I said, hey, dude, you're my soulmate. And he went, broomch. And we were just fast friends.
Were you into Dylan before you met Carrie?
Yes, but not as much.
Yeah, sure.
And I was with Carrie the first time I realized that I could write about Dylan. And I thought, I could do this. And that really, that's why I dedicated my dissertation to him. You know, just, we're going to try not to cry now.
Carrie changed so many lives.
He did. I mean, foundationally for me, that there was just, I did feel like a stranger. And as soon as we had that, I think I met him 3 weeks after I got to Houston. And that was a very lonely 3 weeks. And then after that, you know, I met you and we went to Dylan shows. And so because Dylan's community is a community about love and positivity and so many wonderful things, my experience with you was not Jason Nadler, the genius. It was almost like, I can equate it to the story that Winston Watson tells about his little girl. Dylan, like they were, he was the drummer for Dylan in the 90s, and it's in Ray Padgett's book, but Dylan was late.
He's the one, right, that played something and Dylan said, I love it.
Yeah.
Never do it again.
Yeah,
right?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah.
And so Dylan was late to get on to go on stage, and they were looking for Winston Watson's little girl, and it turned out she was with Dylan. And he comes out and he says, we have to do something about that girl. And Winston's like, oh my goodness. He was so upset that his daughter had delayed, you know, them getting on stage. And he said, apparently she was being bullied by another little girl. And Dylan was talking about the girl that was bullying his daughter. And I think children look at Dylan in a way that they don't bring the baggage of him being Bob Dylan. And that's how I came to you. Like, I didn't know.
I think that allows Dylan to relate to children.
Yes, because there's no expectation.
Yes.
And I knew that you were a playwright and you were brilliant and all of those things because I had seen Roberto Zucco, which you did not direct, but Troy Schultz did, but you were the artistic director. Mm-hmm. And that was transformational for me, especially Drake Simpson's monologue was just beautiful.
Carrie was also wonderful in that.
Yes, and that's why I went to see it. But I think that there, you know, so we can talk about Carrie a little bit because he was one of the three boxers in Speeding Motorcycle. And what was it that drew you to Daniel Johnston's music? Is it similar to Dylan? And then, you know, we could talk about your process. And I'll tell you that as I was preparing for this, I think I told you already, I watched Carrie's performance on YouTube of Forever and it gutted me.
Yeah, me too. Daniel appealed to me because I think he might be the most nakedly emotional writer, songwriter at least, mm-hmm. ever.
Right.
You know, the character that Carrie played and was also played by Kyle and Joe, mm-hmm. Because there were three actors playing the same character, was
right.
Joe the Boxer.
Right.
Joe the Boxer, his skull is cut off at the top.
Yep.
And the best way to interpret that, I think, is that he had no protective mechanism mm-hmm. against things getting in.
Right.
Or things getting out. You know, he was very inappropriate with a lot of people, and that, you know, was hurtful to him to know that he was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really into several songs by him, and then I was asked to create this rock opera, which I was very excited to do because I was a huge fan. I listened to his entire catalog. I had to create it in like 4 weeks and then rehearse it for 3 weeks, which was less time than I've ever rehearsed a play. It's entirely new. But during that process, I became absolutely obsessed with Daniel, even to the point where, I mean, I know every one of the words to every one of Dylan's songs. When I was working on this project, I forgot all of Dylan's lyrics.
Wow.
And I just knew every word and all of the melodies to Daniel's songs. Mm-hmm. He's just a really deeply feeling artist. And the characters that he draws as well. And there's so much interaction between his art and his music. It's a world that he's invented for himself.
In what ways, are there ideas that are in Johnston's music that you see parallel to Dylan's, or some that are different in terms of empathy and humanity?
Well, I don't think that ideas are very much involved in Daniel's
music.
Or the
music. Feelings, I should say.
You know? Well, I think that they are because they're unavoidable for
him.
And I mean, he's very smart. He's very clever. He's an incredible lyricist. I think he has an incredible singing voice. I love his piano playing. I think that a distinction between the two is that Dylan is able to operate as an artist at a remove sometimes, and sometimes he needs to.
Right.
Now, Daniel needed to do that too, but he couldn't.
Okay.
Like, there was no way. It's like Sarah Kane, who's one of my three favorite playwrights, the most notorious playwright of the late 20th century, and I'm co-directing a play by her with my partner T right now. At her funeral, because she only wrote five plays, they're tremendously important plays, and then she hanged herself at the age of 28. So that's the entire catalog. At her funeral, the great playwright Harold Pinter said, the thing with Sarah Kane was she was missing a layer of skin.
Wow.
You know? And so she couldn't help it. Like, she couldn't stop feelings from getting in. Daniel is like that, or was.
Why you had
I think Dylan can just, like, put on a hoodie and some sunglasses and I think that he can write, you know, finger-pointing songs that are very intentional, you know? Now, they're not, because we're not just reading the news item about William Sansinger and Hattie Carroll, we're not having the same emotional response. So Dylan makes it an emotional thing, but it's a conscious thing that he's doing, even in the protest songs, you know?
That's, I mean, that's something that my friend Roberta and I talk about a lot, that especially in particular, that song, that he's telling you you have to wait for your reaction, and so you're just waiting, like, is it going to get better, but it just keeps getting worse. And I don't think through that song is all emotion for me. And then when you get to that the end, the payoff, when he says now is the time for your tears,
but the choruses that lead up to that, where he's telling you not to do this,
but you're still feeling.
But it's a real object lesson in thinking versus feeling.
Right.
Because he keeps saying, who philosophize disgrace, philosophize is thinking.
Right.
Disgrace is a feeling.
Criticize all fears.
Yes.
Yeah.
Criticism is a thought.
Right.
Fears are feelings.
Right.
You know.
And then at the end he says, now feel this.
And even in Hurricane, you know, couldn't help but make me feel ashamed that I live in a land where justice is a game.
Right.
Ashamed. You know, it's a political song. He's telling a story that's important that way. But he's telling it emotionally, you know.
And you don't, you do think outrage, but you feel outraged by the things that he's showing you. And he's, you know, if you are inspired to act, then you act.
So, now we all know about injustice,
correct.
You know, but he's able to make that emotional for him.
And again, it's that element of empathy that then.
Yes.
Allows us to connect to other people's experiences.
And the transference of, and I think all great art is personal. So somebody creates something that's very personal to them. I don't know if I've already said this.
Maybe.
They create something that's very personal to them in a way that it can be conveyed to someone else and it can be personal to them.
Right.
And that creates empathy.
Yes.
I mean,
that's exactly the point. I mean, I think that was the point of your initial text and what you say, that when you found Dylan as, you know, a mentor or a father figure. It was that it was teaching you how to feel your way through life in ways that seemed acceptable, or, you know, he condoned them in a way that it's just quite lovely. Also in that text, you quoted Samuel Beckett, and I love that quote. And I'm going to ask you about Beckett because when you were doing Waiting for Godot just recently, so my friend who is Rob Virginio, who's a Beckett scholar, emailed me, and I think I put you in touch with Rob, but he said, did you know that this production is going on in your town? I said, yes, and I know who's doing it. So you said Beckett, he never felt a kick because he thought it, nor thought a kick because he felt one. And I love that. So why do you think there's this crossover between Dylan people? Because he's not the only one. There's a whole field of Irish studies folks, and in particular Beckett folks, who respond to Dylan. And I think, you know, there's sort of a crossover there. What do you think that crossover is? Because clearly you're one as well.
I've been asked, like, can't you feel something and think something at the same time? And, you know, that was a little bit of a vexing question for me for just a moment. And then I thought, you can feel something and then think about it.
Right.
That's what you do.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's what you do. You feel something about the music and whatever else about Dylan.
Right.
And then you write about it.
Right.
You know, so you use your heart and then you use your head.
Yeah.
It doesn't work the other way around. You don't think about something and later that makes you feel something. You know, that's akin to having a dream. And when you wake up, and that's mysterious, right? It's mystical. It's completely outside of our realm of understanding. And then you wake up and you try to analyze the dream so that you can understand it. So you felt something and then you think something. I don't think that you can do both at the same time, and I don't think that they have anything to do with one another, really. And that's what that quote means.
Yeah, but why do we get stuck in that trap, though, of thinking over feeling? Is it a safe space, a safer place to be in the realm of thought than feeling? Because feeling
gets... Yes, absolutely. It is necessary as human animals living on the planet Earth that we suppress our feelings constantly. We are the only, because it is part of a very important social contract.
I was just going to say that's the social contract, isn't it?
Yes, it is. When we are hungry, we don't just grab food, right? At best, that's theft.
Right.
At worst, it's, I don't know. When we are, let's say, aroused, you know, sexually aroused, we don't just grab someone who we're attracted to. That happens in the animal kingdom, but it doesn't happen here. So we don't indulge our feelings. We have to keep them in. It's very important. It's important for just walking around in the world. How are you is such a strange question to me, because nobody really wants, it's a polite gesture.
Right.
Nobody really wants you to answer it.
Right.
They would be so much more comfortable if you just pulled down your pants and bent over than actually telling them how you feel about something. So it's a dangerous thing. It's a vulnerability that's dangerous to share with people. So we think instead. We rationalize things instead.
There are two follow-ups. One is just a quick. There was a woman I knew in New Jersey, and she used to say, "How you doing, Aaron? All right?" And I'd say, "Sure." Because she had already answered it for me. She had no interest in how I was. She was just, all right, like, okay, that's fine. But I think it goes back to, again, art and catharsis, that is the space where we feel, because all of those repressed feelings, you know, we can say catharsis in an ancient Greek drama type of way, or a more modern sense, Stephen King's Why We Crave Horror Films, because we are allowed to experience emotions and reactions, fear, love, anger, whatever it is that we don't necessarily experience or that we repress. I mean, it's Bakhtinian carnival, in essence.
That reminds me of another quote from Sarah Kane, who was described as having created a theater of extremes, who was sort of named the mother of in-your-face theater. Very intense emotionally very intense place. And in defense of this, just trying to say, I'm not creating these shock value plays. These are ways to tell stories, you know, about difficult things. And she says, I would rather risk an overdose in art than in life. And so I feel like that's a safe space for catharsis. Whereas the walking around world is absolutely not.
No.
You know, you're going to wind up locked up if you do that.
Yeah. If you feel too much when you're out in the world.
Yeah. Makes people very uncomfortable,
Where am I going with this? I have more questions, I promise. So, okay, this was, I thought, oh, this is a good question to ask because I think your approach will be so different, and maybe I'm patting myself on the back too much and we can edit this out, but we know Girl from the North Country is coming.
Yeah.
And maybe if I'm lucky enough, you'll go see it with me.
Oh, I'm definitely going. I'd love to see it with you.
Excellent. That would be so much fun.
Yeah.
I know. Okay, so for the style of play it is, it's a great production, but if you had written it, how would you have approached it? What does that play look like? And what songs would you use? What story would you tell?
Well, when I was creating the Daniel thing, like maybe three of the songs in the play were among my favorite Daniel songs.
Okay.
It was the songs that served the narrative. And I think that is also common to Conor McPherson's, the way that he created that play, the musical. If I knew how to do the Dylan play or
so
musical,
Dylan
I would
comes
have done
to you
it.
And says, okay. Jason, write a musical.
You know, he did come to McPherson. He was the one that started all that.
Right, right.
You know, I don't want to meet Dylan.
I don't either.
I have nothing to say to him.
Nope.
I think he would be uncomfortable. He's uncomfortable with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
I would be more uncomfortable.
I would be so uncomfortable. What am I going to ask him? Do you like egg salad? Like, everybody's asked him everything. Like,
Carolyn Wonderland said my name to him once, and I was like, good enough.
Was that the 03 tour when she played with him at the Ariel? I think he was playing.
When she came into town to meet him, and they jammed a lot. And,
yeah.
And eventually, he did ask her to go on tour as his lead guitar player.
Yeah.
And I saw her at a show about 2 weeks later, and I said, hey, when are you going? What's going on? And she said, throw my ticket out the window. And I believe that she was replaced by Charlie Sexton. I'm not sure.
Right.
You would know the years better than I would. I think it was 2005 or 2006 when that
happened.
I mean, she met him in 2003.
Right.
And then they would meet up across the country when their tours intersected.
Okay.
Dylan asked her to, he said, I have an idea for a project. I want to re-record a lot of my classic songs with entirely new lyrics. Would you write me a new version of Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat? And so she went off and wrote several pages on a loose leaf notebook, tore it out, gave it to him, and he read it and he laughed and he said, this is dirty, you know. He never wound up doing that project.
Right.
Unless, because I can draw a line from that to Shadow Kingdom.
Or Mondo Scripto. Because Mondo Scripto is the art exhibit where he re-envisions his lyrics.
Yeah,
you would love that. He does Shelter from the Storm in like four different ways and changes the lyrics. I mean,
only four different ways?
I think it's only maybe. No, he does it in concert too, because I pointed that out in the live Budokan.
Yeah.
He makes a really important change to the lyrics. But he just reworks all of his lyrics and then draws pictures, and probably the most, as Laura Tenchant says, the most obvious drawings to go with the songs, but I wonder if that interaction kind
of I don't know, or
intersects.
Maybe it went nowhere, this thing
that
Carolyn did with him. But she came around during our 10th anniversary and said she just needed to stop by quickly on her way back to Austin. She only had a minute, but she wanted to tell me that she'd been hanging out with Dylan, and out of nowhere he said, have you ever done any music videos? And she said, no. And this was the really out of nowhere thing. He said, have you ever done any theater? You ever acted in any plays? And she said, yeah, man. I played Photo Chick in the original production of In the Under Thunderloop by my friend Jason Nadler. Photo Chick also, by the way, stolen from the liner notes of one of Dylan's early albums.
I wonder if he recognized that or if he's just done so much. It was just,
I don't, who knows?
Right.
And he just said, cool. You know, and I'm
That's
like,
awesome.
You said my name to him? Terrific. You know?
That's very cool.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't remember what the question was.
The question was if you were going to write Girl from the North Country or the Dylan play, what songs would you pick?
If I was going to write that play, I would let you know when it was opening. And I'd figure it out as I went along, and I'd let you know when it was going to be on. I don't have an idea for that. I don't know which songs would be in that. They would be whichever songs served the narrative.
Okay.
And I would find a way for some of the most important songs to me to serve the narrative.
Like It's All Right, Ma.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that one.
All right. Are there any songs that you know? No, not that one.
I think that Nobody Except You would be in it.
Yeah.
I think that Spanish Harlem Incident would be in it.
Okay.
I mean, when I'm asked, what do you want to hear Dylan play tonight? It's always Spanish Harlem Incident.
We've had that discussion. What do you want to hear Dylan play tonight? I was like, he would not stop playing. It would just be, a four-day show if he played everything I wanted
him
to play.
That's up on top for me.
Right,
I think he hasn't played it since Carnegie Hall in 64.
All right, so there is a story that you've been promising to tell me about Dylan walking through the audience at the Beacon.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So will you please share that with us now?
Do you want to set up what actually happened?
Yeah,
the way that
you
know it, and then I can tell you.
No, you can. No, you set it up.
Okay, so Dylan had a four-night stand at the Beacon.
Yep.
I was in college. I don't know how I saved up the money to do this because I just waited tables, but I got good tickets.
Priorities. That's how.
To the yes, absolutely. to the first three of the four shows, I couldn't afford a ticket to the fourth one.
Okay.
But I saw that people were scalping them for much less than I had paid, and there were empty seats.
Right.
Right? Especially because it was a four-night stand. And Dylan's, you know, his cachet wasn't great at that time. It was late 80s, you know,
right.
So that was a low period for him. I figured I can come up there and scalp some tickets for the fourth night. That's not going to be a problem.
Right.
But a rumor went around that Jerry Garcia was in town and was going to join him on stage, and so those tickets got bought up like that.
Yeah, of course.
You know, people paid a lot. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get a ticket. I stood by, this is the story of the night that Dylan actually got off the stage,
right.
Walked through the crowd playing harmonica, took a right at the crowd break and walked out the side door onto the street. And the band appeared to have no idea what was going on. Apparently they did.
Right.
But, and they're all looking back and like, do we stop? What are we supposed to do? And he was just gone.
Right.
You know, apparently he just got in a cab or a car or something and split.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in the arena when that happened.
Right.
My ear was pressed up against a door with about six other people trying to listen to which songs he was playing for a personal set list that we were making. And then...
Back in the day when we had someone call and write down the set list when it wasn't online immediately. Right.
But I needed a copy for myself.
Of course.
You know, and he was playing very different things. Of course.
And you needed one for Carrie anyway.
Yeah. I needed one for anyone that I knew cared about him a lot. So I was doing that, and all of a sudden the door is pushed open from the inside by like a security person or one of Dylan's people, and he's like, come on in, you can come in for the encore. And so we all, great, you know, we win,
right.
You know, and we ran in there for the encore, we ran up to get as close as we could. Dylan gets off the stage and does this thing, which was mind-blowing, and we come to realize that's why they let us in off the street. Otherwise, he has fans right outside there where he's trying to escape.
Oh, yeah,
right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But you got to get in, and you didn't have to pay.
I got to get in, and I saw that thing happen, which I don't know if it ever happened before or after.
How close was he to where, walking by you?
I'd say about maybe eight seats away.
All right. Yeah. That's very cool. Yeah. All right. You mentioned that you're working on a play, Sarah Kane play, with your partner, T.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, and then where we can see it, when it's... You know, when your performances are. I know you're in rehearsal now, right? Or you're in rehearsal on your birthday.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to miss all of those Dylan shows.
All the Dylan shows I'm going to.
Yes. Yeah. Cleansed is Sarah Kane's most intense play. It's often described as an impossible play or an unproducible play because of all of the different terrible things that happen and the special effects you need to make them happen. And people do it one of two ways.
Okay.
And one is that they try to make it all realistic. And these are brutal things that happen to these people. It takes place in a sort of a mysterious institution designed to rid society of its undesirables. And these terrible tortures are performed on them. If you play that realistically, as they did at the National Theatre in London several years ago, a very large theatre with a great reputation, people were carried out on stretchers. People were vomiting. They were fainting.
Oh, that was goodness.
Never what Sarah Kane intended.
Right.
She always said that she wanted her work to be representational, that these things were happening to present the character, that it was a play about love, and that these challenges were being presented to see if love could overcome the greatest obstacles. And so it's a fable. We're treating it like a fable. And when at the beginning of the play, we're going to have the actors walk out in street clothes, and they're going to shed enough of their costumes that we see that they are wearing completely fake genitals, obviously fake genitals. We take steps throughout the entire play to remind people that we're telling a fable. You know, we're not trying to say this really happened. I saw an episode of, I don't know, Family Guy or Simpsons or something.
Yeah.
Somebody's having a dream and they look down, their legs have been chopped off. And they're just like, what's going on? It's weird.
Right.
You know, so that's sort of the dream logic that fills this play up, you know? And so people think of Sarah Kane as a shock value playwright. She is, she is like Dylan in that in her 20s, she already knew everything. She had already studied everything so thoroughly.
Right.
You know, she knew everything about theater. She had read everything. She'd listened to everything. And that's much like Dylan. So she knew what she was doing.
It's a beautiful concept too, and it seems that people misunderstand that they're looking at, again, the shock value, the horror of it, and not seeing that underlying that is you know, this empathy and love, and will that triumph over all of the horrors that human beings can do to each other?
Yeah. Sarah Kane also believed that no one is just a victim or a perpetrator. Mm-hmm. She believed that everyone is a victim, perpetrator, and bystander.
Yeah.
So she doesn't judge her villains or whatever. The people who do terrible things in her plays are very sympathetic characters.
Yeah.
And we get a sense of why they do that.
There's a complexity. Every time, you know, there are a few things that I was thinking as a follow-up, but anytime I meet someone just in person or a character in a play, novel, whatever, that's reprehensible. I try to find something redeemable about that person or understand, find the point of empathy of where did the person become hardened, you know, and then perpetrate these atrocities on someone else.
Become hardened or what happened to them? You know, I'll say something radical that's going to make everybody turn off the podcast and hate you for having me on.
No, say it.
I have tremendous empathy for sociopaths, psychopaths, and even pedophiles because nobody is born bad.
This is your Tom Paine moment, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, so to speak.
Yeah,
of course.
Oh, there you go.
But, you know, I'll say why, and maybe it isn't.
Right.
I don't believe that anyone is born bad. Yep. I believe something happens to everybody.
Agreed.
And I feel very deeply for the people who walk around in the world with these problems, because it disconnects them from the world. It fills them with self-loathing. Mm-hmm. A pedophile that acts on their impulses needs to be put away from society.
Right.
Okay. But they have been damned. I mean, they are living a damned existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of empathy for that.
And I always question that, you know, we make the joke of like, oh, that person needed to be loved or they didn't get hugged enough or something. But there's something to that, to having the love and support of another person that, you know, in a very raw moment, I'll tell you that when my grandmother died, I felt that I'd lost an ally because she was someone who looked at me and even in my worst moments still saw that there was something good, that she knew that I was good and I was just not at my best self. And we all need that. And I feel a lot of those people aren't fortunate enough to have those people in their lives. You did almost get me in trouble once. I thought I'd brought students to one of your plays and this was my fault.
I shouldn't have done that.
I know, and they were dual credit students, so they were in high school. And it was, I forget what play it was, but it was full frontal male nudity. And I just like, oh, it's a Friday. I'm so getting fired on Monday.
Oh, I didn't direct that.
You didn't direct it, but it was a catastrophic play.
I can't even remember that. I never have nudity in my
plays. No.
It's too distracting. You put somebody naked on stage, you can't think about anything else.
But, and all of my students, little Clear Lake High School kids, were, and I was like, oh. And I said, on Monday when I saw them, they said, we didn't tell our parents. I said, thank you. They loved the play.
Oh, good. That's
I just
great.
Thought I'm absolutely getting fired for this.
I'm glad you didn't.
I didn't. Because I do love teaching. I love what I do. Yeah. All right. So anything else you'd like to talk about or share about Dylan, about your work, about just what a beautiful, lovely human being you are?
Well, I don't have anything to say about that because I don't feel that.
Well,
I
will affirm it every day.
Have I talked about how Dylan the singer is so much more potent to me than the songwriter?
You didn't. I think you should.
I think Dylan is the greatest songwriter ever.
Yes.
I think his competition is
unassailable.
Maybe only Leonard Cohen.
Agreed.
Maybe Joni Mitchell.
Okay.
That's not why I love him.
Mm-hmm.
I love him because of his singing, because of the way that he sings with such abandon. I sing along with that abandon in the car. I do it at home with my partner. They have a photo on my phone that's so embarrassing. I'm topless and I'm just like playing.
I love that.
Like everything, I'm letting everything out.
Can that be the photo that goes with this podcast?
Well, I can. Yeah, let me see if it's okay with T. I mean, I think it would be.
If it's not, that's perfectly acceptable.
So, there are front people who in bands who do the same thing. They perform with total abandon. They go unconscious. They don't know what's going on. I've always made my actors go see them and say, that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go unconscious, you drop in, you're in the moment, you don't know what's happening, but it can be completely spontaneous. So the way that he sings with abandon, I mean, it's almost like the sounds are more important to me than the words, you know?
Yep.
The words are very meaningful to me, but it's the sounds and it's the singing. I mean, his interviews are very powerful to me, you know, really everything about him is. The other thing that I always feel like I want to say about Dylan comes from having been in playwriting school at NYU. And I was an undergrad, and we were each assigned to graduate students to sort of be their assistants and create, you know, helping to shepherd their thesis playthrough. Mm-hmm. And I went over to this other student's, you know, apartment, and she, her entire record catalog was punk rock. Mm-hmm. And then I looked a little bit more closely, and she had 12 Bob Dylan albums. Yeah. And I said, what's going on? Like, this is all punk rock, but you've got these 12 Bob Dylan albums. Mm-hmm. And she said, nobody is more punk rock than Dylan. And nobody is. And he's still more punk rock than anybody.
That's awesome, because in the liner notes to the new Budokan bootleg, uh-huh. Edna Gunderson says that when, you know, punk rock came out, they were lambasting all the old guys from the 60s and the early 70s, and Dylan was unassailable. And maybe that's why, because no one's more punk rock than Dylan.
He was punk before anybody was punk.
That's awesome. Yeah. Anything else that we have to talk about? We've run the gamut, I think.
You're awesome.
You're awesome.
And I adore you. I love you.
I love you too.
And thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. This is wonderful. And it was incredibly meaningful to have you on as the first guest, you know, so we could just sit and chat and talk about Dylan, something we love, in honor of someone we love, Carrie Wynn Scott, with someone we love. So I appreciate you starting this off in the best possible way.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for watching the first episode of Infinity Goes Up on Trial, and please stay tuned and look for the next one out on May 1st.
This episode is dedicated to and in memory of our dear sweet friend, Carrie Wynn Scott, who knows there's no success like failure, and that failure's no success at all.